Welcome to episode 39 of Girls on Pop. I am your co-host, Marina Antunes, joined by fellow co-host,
Ashley Lynch.
Miss Ashley, how you doing?
I am doing fantastic. I'm doing good. I am slowly recovering. If you might remember from last episode, the sinus infection from hell that just won't go away. So it's still kind of like lingering in the background, but I'm mostly over it. So that's good.
Well, and it will not affect the fact that we're going to talk about a lot of stuff today.
So much stuff.
Okay, let's start with some news. Because I have to say, when I saw this headline, I was like, what is happening? So the major headline was earlier in the week, Victoria Alonso left Marvel. And I think, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was nothing about like firing. It was Victoria Alonso no longer at Marvel. And it was like, what happened?
It was just like she exits.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, well, what's this about? Because there were so few details and she's been like at Marvel since the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. So it was a really, really big deal, not only because of that, but also...
And a high-ranking producer at Marvel.
Exactly. High-ranking producer, woman, been there forever. Like, what's happened? Clearly, like, there was a story here that needed a little more information. And then later in the week, IndieWire has put together some reporting from various sources that apparently she was fired by Disney for breach of contract? Like, what? And then you read the details and it's like the stupidest thing ever.
Yeah, so Disney, it looks like Disney's official statement is that she was essentially fired for breach of contract for working on another film for a competing studio. She worked on the film Argentina 1985, which got an Oscar nomination. And it's basically part of her non-compete clause is that she's not allowed to go work for competing studio during that time. And it sounds like she could have sought to get an exception from Disney for this, but she chose not to for whatever reason. And Disney has decided to exercise that clause and just fire her for this, which... I'm reticent to kind of pick sides or come to any conclusions because I'm sure more information is going to come out and everything at this point is like a little bit speculative. But at the same time, it seems really silly to me. And especially when you consider how long she's been at Marvel, how many movies she's worked on at Marvel, and for her to work on this one smaller film about something that is very clearly important to her because Victoria Alonso is an Argentinian gay woman and she helped produce a film that was about prosecuting the military dictatorship that disappeared thousands and thousands of people in Argentina. And so obviously it was something that was very important to her. And she chose to be part of that. And it just feels kind of petty to try to excise her from the Marvel project for something like that. Apparently, Disney took it as a big slight that Victoria Alonso was there at the Oscars, not in support of Wakanda Forever, but there in support of Argentina 1985.
I mean, I just don't even know what to say at this point. I'm with you. I do think there's probably more to the story here than we're getting, and it's going to be a long time, if ever, that we're going to get the full spectrum of exactly what happened. There has also been some speculation that, you know, I personally don't agree with this. I think that there's a bigger story here in when we talk about visual effects. But one of the things that's mentioned in that article is that she also like oversees the visual effects for the majority of the Marvel films, and that they haven't really been up to par over the last couple of movies. And I disagree with that. I mean, personally, I think that there's those movies, like superhero movies in general are just visual effects heavy and they like lean on the big action sequences a little too much and they're very heavy. They're pretty much all green screen and visual effects. And that's like another issue that's like unrelated to this, I think. It's just a matter of there's a lot of work to be done in a very short period of time for very little money, all things considered. So I don't know. I think that there's more at play there, and I don't think that that's a valid point. But I do think that in the end, like, my knee jerk was like, well, in the end, Marvel and Disney are going to come out the losers on this end, because they've lost a highly skilled producer that has decades of experience working in this genre that's extremely lucrative for them. And she is most likely going to be scooped up by another studio, because there's no way that either Amazon or Netflix, or my gut feeling is Warner Brothers, isn't going to try to scoop her up, because, hi, she's got...
Maybe Peter Safran's reaching out to her right now.
This is exactly it. Like, I don't think that there is a lack of, you know, interest in Victoria Alonso. The other thing that somebody brought up that I thought was a really valid point as well is she's been doing this for a long time, like superhero movies. Perhaps, you know, this is, and, you know, the fact that Argentina 1985 is the film that, you know, causes all this drama, perhaps it's, you know, she's going to look for something different. Maybe she doesn't want to do superhero movies anymore.
Yeah, she's like 31 movies deep. If she wanted to, you know, said, okay, I'm kind of done with Marvel, there'd be, you know, definitely more graceful ways to exit than this. But, you know, it's, it at the same time, it doesn't seem that way because she's fighting it. She's lawyered up and she's you know, taken Dizzy to task for this and not... just like going quiet, you know, if she wanted to just say, I'm done, this is my quiet way of just exiting the company, it's time for me to move on to other stuff, which I would totally get that. But if that were the case, I don't think she would be like, oh, now it's time to make noise and retaliate either. She would just move on.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't quite buy into that. I've heard the speculation that it's retaliation for Quantumania, and she's basically being the fall guy for it. I've heard that it's about people being unhappy with the VFX output for the last few films. I've heard that it's Bob Iger trying to reel in how much Marvel is spending on VFX on these movies, and then again, she is being the fall guy for it. This is all just blatant speculation, and honestly, people don't know. So I try not to entertain that stuff, because I don't think you can take it seriously. The only thing we know for sure is Disney said specifically, we're exercising our non-compete clause, and that's why we decided to get rid of Victoria Alonso, and that her lawyers fired back with their own statement, basically agreeing with that and saying that, you know, that they were agreeing with that's why she was let go, and saying that's ridiculous that Disney chose to take this route. And I think you're right. I think it is going to blow up in Disney's face, because essentially it's there's no kind of like great winning side on an optics level here, because it's taking aim at a smaller, important, politically viable film. And they have chosen to excise from the company a very kind of entrenched high-ranking producer from these films, but also the fact that part of apparently why Victoria Alonso was not on such great ground with a lot of execs at Disney is because she was very vocal in speaking out against how Disney was handling the entire debacle with the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida with Disney World. And apparently her speaking out is part of the reason that Disney finally kind of like stepped up to the plate against DeSantis. So it kind of, like, I just watched Argentina 1985, which I highly recommend to everyone. I think it's a great little movie. It is an excellent little film that shows the problem with when you finally get fascism out of power is you have to deal with
the aftermath.
All the people in the populace who are still sympathetic to fascism and try to change their mind. And it's hard not to look at the parallels with what's going on in Florida right now and say, hey, maybe fascism is a real problem that this country needs to take seriously. And let's face it, Argentina 1985 is a more important movie than any of the Marvel movies, as much as I love the Marvel movies, and I've said that many times. So, you know, there's a lot of elements where Disney just looks like the bad person. They look bad and petty, no matter what. the outcome is here. And Victoria, whether or not she is brought back into Disney, doesn't sound like she will be. Or why would she want to at this point? And we'll move on to greater, better things, you know, because she is not a not in demand producer.
Exactly. She's Victoria,
no problem getting work.
Call me. Please reply to my emails now that you're no longer at Disney, because getting through your layers of people has been a nightmare for 5 years. Now that you're free of that, Spark wants you. Just saying. But yeah, well, let's jump into some movies, shall we? Mm-hmm. Should we start with a little bit of cocaine and a little bit of Bear?
You know, if there's one thing or two things that go together like chocolate and peanut butter, it's cocaine and bears.
Oh, man.
I don't know. This is one of those movies that was like a meme before it even hit theaters. People were so amped for it. It didn't matter what this movie was. People were ready for it.
Yep.
And the fact that it had like a pretty kick-ass trailer that preceded it certainly didn't hurt things.
So the basic concept here is this is based on vaguely true events.
Barely true. In reality, the bear swallows some cocaine and then died.
Pretty much.
That's it.
Yeah, pretty much. They find a dead bear with a block of cocaine in its stomach. The story here is the cocaine lands in the forest, the bear gets into the cocaine, becomes addicted, and all kind of hell breaks loose when the drug dealers come back trying to rescue their cocaine because, you know, somebody needs to get paid. Let's be honest.
There's a drug addicted apex predator in these woods.
Pretty much. And I'm sorry, but there are some hilarious scenes here of not only bear kills, but also the bear high on cocaine.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's what I think this movie walks a tonal tightrope and manages to do it for the most part pretty successfully. It plays it as a comedy, but it is structured like it's a horror movie. Yep. The bear is a slasher killer, but anytime the bear shows up, you're laughing, you're not, you know, afraid. And it goes there. It's not afraid to be gory. It's not afraid to show you limbs getting ripped off. There's one point in which the bear snorts a line of coke off of a severed leg.
This is the thing that surprised me the most. I was kind of ready for, you know, because I'd seen a lot of interviews with Elizabeth Banks, and they talked a lot about, you know, how they needed to make the bear as real as possible. Otherwise, it was going to look really silly and they wouldn't be able to sell the comedy. So, you know, I was kind of prepared for a realistic bear doing stupid things. But what I was not prepared for was the level of gore in this movie, which is...
Yeah.
It's basically like any great horror movie. There's a lot of it. And it's really well,
even,
well done.
Even then, the realism is a very bendable line. Yes. Because there's some points at which the bear emotes way more than any bear actually can.
Truth.
It starts to have antics.
Yeah, apparently. So nobody knows, right? Because they didn't do any testing to see how do bears act like on cocaine. But yeah. There was some interesting research that they did into the bears. And the scenes that I thought were like the most ludicrous, like there's one where the bear is sitting on her butt and she's like basically like licking cocaine off of her nose and off of her paws. That's actually like, I'm like, oh, that looks so stupid. Like a bear would never do that. Well, I saw footage of an actual bear doing that. Not with cocaine, with honey. Yeah. But I was like, okay, so this is like real thing. So yeah, the stuff that you might think, oh, well, the bear wouldn't do that. Well, we don't know for sure. We're only guessing. But it's as realistic as it could be.
Yeah, no, it totally worked for me. I don't think I think she's right in that the bear needed to be realistic looking to take the movie seriously, but at the same time, they clearly knew they could push and pull that to a certain
degree. For sure.
And it is that delicate balancing act that the entire movie's playing. It's and if I had one complaint about this movie, it's that I think it peaks around the midpoint of the movie with this incredible scene with the ambulance chase. And unfortunately, the movie never gets that good again.
Agreed.
It's still good overall, but it never gets that good. And for me, that was a disappointment. Like, the rule in screenwriting is you want to keep escalating things. So it's like the, you know, the bigger thing is always coming towards the end. You never want to, like, you know, start with something big and then everything just gets smaller from there. Because it doesn't work. It's not cathartic to the audience. And unfortunately, this movie just, like, it gets there too soon.
I fully agree. And,
and doesn't pick it back up.
No, I actually thought that whole waterfall sequence, like, basically is like the entire ending of the movie is really just sort of low energy. I don't know if it's in part the setting and the fact that it's so dark. Like, the whole thing just kind of feels like you say, like, no, there's like almost no energy there. Like,
it feels more like they're trying to pay off the story plot point than they are trying to fulfill the premise.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, I fully agree. That ambulance scene is kind of where you reach, like, maximum, like, holy shit. And then from there, it's just kind of peters out. I still really did enjoy it. I think in part, I did see this with a fairly small group, but I did see it with people. I went to a theater to see it. And I think that certainly helped the enjoyment, because the first, like, kill you see, which I think might be the falling out of the tree, the ranger that falls out of the tree. I think that might be the first one. And we're all kind of like, whoa, what was that? Like, did that really just happen? Mm. And then, you know, it was kind of like, what are they going to do next? So it was really, really fun to watch with the group. I don't think that the enjoyment level would have been quite as high if I'd just seen it at home. On a rental, so I highly recommend seeing it with a group. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty good. Lots of fun. Yeah.
No, I like this one too. It's an easy recommend. Even if you don't love it, it's still a fun time.
It totally is. And it's not like a 3-hour investment. So hey, there's that too.
Exactly.
I think you might have mentioned this one on the last show, or somebody mentioned this one to me, at Knock at the Cabin, which is the new M. Night Shyamalan.
We talked about this one in person a little
bit. Okay, that's what it was, because I finally caught up with this the other day, and,
I'm curious to hear what you thought.
Okay, so the thing that surprised me the most, and it didn't come, like, I kind of picked up on this at the end, because I didn't really know anything going into it other than the fact that Dave Bautista was in it. And I knew, like, this vague idea about the premise, but I had no idea what the hell was going on until I watched the movie. And I was surprised to discover that this is actually based on a book, because I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. So not an original story from Shyamalan, which I'm more used to. Like, I'm not used to him developing material. Like, usually he tells his own.
Oh, I think it's the first time he has.
Oh, okay. It's maybe the... Okay, so, I mean, I really like Servant, but I haven't seen a movie of his. I guess I saw Old, which I didn't care for. But, I mean, I feel like I haven't followed his career for, like, maybe a decade. So I'm not sure if this is even, like, is this movie number 3 that I've liked in the last 10 years? Like, I don't know, because I don't know how many he's put out. But I did enjoy this one for the most part. I found a lot of the, not the plotting, but like the backstory of what exactly was going on was just weird. I just, like, is it a cult? Like, what are they talking about? It's all very vague. I'm like, is it vague on purpose? Does this have a purpose? I was kind of just bored by it, to be totally honest. But I really liked the performances. I thought Bautista was great. I thought Jonathan Groff was excellent. So, I mean, I like the performances and I like the vague concept. But I don't know. Like, it overall, I was just kind of bored by it.
Okay, so there's no real way for me to talk about this movie and my true feelings about this movie without spoiling the hell out
of it. Go for spoilers. It's been out for a while.
So if you're afraid about having Knock at the Cabin spoiled for you, then fast forward, because I'm about to go off. So I absolutely hated this movie. The last time I think I hated a movie as much as I hated Knock at the Cabin is when I saw Sucker Punch. So that's how much I
hate. That is a lot of hate.
It is. And I'm going to validate where that hate comes from. On a technical level, I think this movie is really good. I think it's well shot. I think some of the suspense is good. I think the performances are really good. I particularly like Bautista. The problem is entirely in the execution. And it's not and I haven't read the book, but upon doing further research, this movie completely not only deviates from, but subverts and inverts the ending of the book. So it is the end result of the film is completely different from what happens in the book. So the base premise is that these four cultists show up at this cabin of this family of two guys and their adopted daughter, and basically very politely and calmly take them hostage and say the world is going to end unless one of you kills the other. And we're here to make sure that happens so the world doesn't end. And it plays out slowly until, like, with each successive cult member that essentially commits suicide, you see on the TV a news report of, like, oh, here's a giant tidal wave that's about to crash into, you know, such and such, and then planes start falling out of the skies, and it's like, oh shit, maybe this is real, maybe the wrath of God has come, and the only way this can be stopped is for me to kill my lesbian husband in front of my child. Which there's an interesting conflict that's there, but in execution, it more plays out like zealotry. Now, my biggest problem with this film stems from a very personal standpoint, and there's no way for me to, like, not do one without the other, so bear with me here. There was a time at which I was in a relationship with someone who called me up out of the blue one day and said, we need to leave town. I was like, why? It's like, because on X and X date, there's going to be a major earthquake and we need to be somewhere else. I said, that's ridiculous. We're not going anywhere. And I lived for the next few months with this person as they converted our vehicle into this getaway survival van, convinced that this was going to happen, and all I had to do was basically ride it out until it inevitably did not happen. And those few months were fucking hell living with someone who was so deep in this weird conspiracism that they were willing to completely uproot and harm our lives due to it. And of course, this did not come to pass. There was no earthquake, and absolutely nothing changed, and it didn't convince them of anything. But it allowed them to make my life an absolute living hell in the process, because the two results, the two ultimatums that I was basically given was either accept and buy into this absurd conspiracism, or from their perspective, I'm just sticking my head in the sand and choosing to ignore the inevitable truth. There's only those two options, and both those options suck. And that's where you're kind of stuck when you're with someone who is basically completely baked into QAnon bullshit conspiracism. This is pre-QAnon, but that sort of thing. And so what Knock at the Cabin does is it presents you with a bunch of conspiracy-minded, brain-wormed, paranoid maniacs that take a family hostage, and the twist is that there is no twist. They are right. The wrath of God is coming, and it is only by fulfilling this prophecy that the entirety of, like, humankind is saved. The movie validates this nonsense conspiracism and says, you should listen to QAnon. You should listen to anti-vaxxers. You should listen to people who say that Bill Gates is putting microchips in vaccines. That's what this movie says at the end of it. That's its message. And I fucking hate this movie for it.
That's totally valid. And now that you mention it, I'm kind of thinking, like, I haven't seen season two of Servant, but Servant kind of plays in that same wheelhouse where it's presenting you with a cult that has some very clear and very troubling ideals. And you think, oh, well, these are a bunch of crazy cult people. But the way season one ends, you kind of start to think, well, maybe these people aren't crazy cult people. Maybe there's something to what they're saying. So What the hell is wrong with Shyamalan? What's going on here?
I mean, he's always been one of those guys who's injected a certain amount of faith into his films, and that's fine. Yeah. Like, Signs is largely built on that.
Yep.
And I think that that's fine because it comes from, like, this sort of, like, personal power of faith. But you dig into his stuff, and I can't help but wonder how much, especially in, like, the last, like, you know, 5-8 years as the world is becoming more conspiracy driven, how much Shyamalan's buying into that on a personal level. I mean, only he can say. We can't know what's in the dude's heart for sure. We can only take a look at his films and the messages that he's putting out there. But with Knock at the Cabin, he specifically chose to invert the ending of that film to justify the conspiracists.
Yep.
That is not the book.
Yeah,
the book does not do
that. That's very, very interesting reading into that for sure. And I don't disagree because, I mean, I didn't care for it. Like I say, I like the performances. I thought the rest of the movie was whatever. But
and I will fully admit it is my personal experience that I'm bringing to the table for why it's I don't usually movies are not a trigger point for me. Art is not a trigger point for me. There's usually not a lot of stuff. I can watch some pretty horrible shit in movies, and there's not a lot of stuff that's going to, like, you know, just completely send me. But this is the one thing. And this movie just really stuck its finger on that nerve that is specific to me and pressed hard. And I hate the movie for it.
Well, I'm not upset about it, so hey. But I am now a little more...
you're more upset that I hated Sucker Punch.
Probably, because I mean, people know how I feel about that movie, and I've defended that movie over the course of, like, however long it's been out, like, 10, 15 years at this point. I'm still not over it, but it's fine. Here's one that we can probably disagree on a happier note. Operation Fortune, the new Guy Ritchie movie. Because we also talked about this offline, and I certainly like this more than you did.
Did you say the full title? Operation Fortune Ruse de Guerre.
No, because I refuse to give it any additional titles. It is called Operation Fortune, and that is it.
Wait a minute. Why is it called Operation Fortune? Why does it have that title?
I have no fucking idea. It's a Guy Ritchie movie. Who cares?
It's called Operation Fortune because Jason Statham's character's name in the movie is Orson Fortune.
Oh, is it? I didn't even know. Look, oh, maybe I did, because I think they call him Fortune all the time.
Yeah, his name is Orson Fortune, and so it is called Operation Fortune. This is the stupidest naming I've ever seen.
Look, I've come to the point where I will fully admit this movie is not great. Mm. However, it's a Guy Ritchie movie that's kind of fun, that's way more fun than probably has any right of being. So the basic premise here is Jason Statham is this Fortune dude who is maybe MI5. Like, I'm not actually even 100% sure what spy agency he belongs to, but Cary Elwes is his handler. They have this job that needs to be done, so they bring together this team, which is led by Jason Statham. He's got Audrey Plaza in tow, and who's the other person? He's got another guy. Can't remember the other guy.
He's got Josh Hartnett.
Yeah, Josh Hartnett comes in. So they basically have to wait. So the point here is Hugh Grant is the broker for some, like, major $1 billion. They think it's a weapons trade, and they got to figure out what they're selling and to whom. That's the essential basics of it. What I like about this movie is it's not that smart. It's not Mission Impossible, let's be honest. Like, there are no, like, crazy awesome stunts. It's a very straightforward, mediocre spy movie, but you got Jason Statham and Aubrey Plaza being pretty awesome, because Jason Statham is also always awesome. Aubrey Plaza is pretty fun, and it has this, the fact that it doesn't take place anywhere where, like, usual spy movies take place, I think is what sells it for me. It's very exotic. Like, they're in Dubai, they're in, I don't know, in France, I think, at one point. They end up in L.A. to pick up Josh Hartnett, and it's like an unrecognizable desert. airplane field place. I don't know. It just kind of feels different. And I'm okay with that. It's just a fun, really long, but really fun. That's my take on it.
I think we set this up to make it sound like I'm a lot more down on this movie than I really am.
It's just not great.
No, it's not great. And there are parts of it that are fun. There's a lot of stuff in here that does work. The cast is great. Anytime Aubrey Plaza's on screen, it is a lot of
fun. She's great.
Hugh Grant is having so much fun in this movie. And just like in general, Hugh Grant seems to be having so much fun. He looks like he's having so much fun in Dungeons & Dragons. And I can't remember what the last thing it was I saw him in, but he looked like he was having a lot of fun there, too. He just looks like he's having fun in general. And I really dig that. And Josh Hartnett, a guy I have not seen in a minute. And he's lovely here. He's basically playing like an egotistical actor who is forced to play himself so that they can get access to Hugh Grant. And he's really stuck in this idea of, like, how do I play myself? And that's his entire, like, dilemma. And it's honestly, it's kind of delightful to see Josh Hartnett go through that. And then Jason Statham just doing the action stuff, and he's doing what he does. And it's like, it feels like everyone here is working to bring this film up to a level that the script demands it never reach.
Because
the script is fucking garbage. Oh,
it's not great. And I mean, some of the logistics of it makes no sense. But you're like, whatever, I'm just going to go with it.
Yeah, and that's fine. If it were an incredibly fun film, and while there are fun moments to be had, and while everyone looks like they're having fun, and the cast is really fun, for the most part, the movie just kind of meanders and is dull. The movie isn't as fun as all of the fun elements that are in it.
It's true.
That was my biggest problem with it, is by the time I got to the end, I was like, I can't even remember what just happened. And I'm not even sure I enjoyed it all that much. But I know I felt like I was, like, entertained while it was going on. It was incredibly forgettable. I don't care if they ever do a sequel to one of these. I don't care if I ever revisit Orson Fortune. I find it kind of funny because Guy Ritchie started out his career working with Matthew Vaughn as his producer, doing stuff like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch. And then Matthew Vaughn went off on his own and started doing some really kick-ass movies, including, well, Kick-Ass, and then, of course, the Kingsman movies. And the thing that I couldn't help but feel while I was watching this Guy Ritchie spy action film was that what it really needed was some Matthew Vaughn Kingsman in it.
Yeah, I needed some of that energy.
To, like, bring it up to that level, and it just isn't here.
No,
it doesn't get there.
No, it doesn't. It really does kind of, like, meddle in the, you know, forgettable, if I never see this again, I'm not going to, like, regret it kind of thing. On the other hand, I think it also shows, like, for me, I think it shows promise with Statham and Plaza, who I think make a really good comedic duo. I would love to see them work together again. And I mean, honestly, if I were to see Statham and Plaza and Cary Elwes together in another movie in that same sort of dynamic, I'd be all over it because I did really enjoy that. I just wish the movie had it's lacking the kinetic energy. Yeah. And even the big action sequences just kind of feel like, sort of like, that was really the major action sequence. Like, the whole car chase thing is so silly, and there's, like, no energy in it. Like, the cars are moving really fast, and there's lots of shooting going on, and you're like, I'm not excited. Like, this is just kind of happening on screen, and I'm like, whatever.
It even feels pretty low tier for Guy Ritchie.
It does. It does.
He's done better action.
He has done better action. That said, I don't regret seeing it. I don't know if I would, like, highly recommend it to people, but I certainly had fun
watching
it.
It's a very mid movie.
It totally is. Like, my dad will love this. He'll totally dig it. And I'm like, yeah, sure. There are worse things to watch. I really did enjoy it, but, you know, not enough to go out of my way to say, yeah, you got to see this movie. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's a good lazy Sunday afternoon.
Oh, it totally is. It totally is. So, yeah, vote for me. I say, yeah, you could watch it. It's fun. There's worse ways to spend your...
I say go ahead and watch it, but I probably, like, vocally liked it a little bit less than...
Oh, for sure. For sure. Okay, another one that we maybe don't fully disagree on, but I think you probably liked this more than I did, and that's...
I guarantee I did.
Yeah, Scream 6. So I'm going to preface this by saying I'm pretty certain... I've seen the first two Scream movies. I may have seen the third. I think I watched one in the middle somewhere. Don't know for sure if I did. So I came into this basically knowing nothing other than what I knew from the previous Scream movies.
But you'd seen five, right?
No.
Oh, you haven't
seen I don't think I've seen four or five.
Okay. Because 5 is essentially, like, the start of, like, this new sort of trilogy from the Radio Silence guys.
Sorry, but no, I haven't seen it.
So,
don't know anything about it.
Yes. So, I mean, yeah, like, the first four movies, Wes Craven movies, and then the, which, I'll be honest and upfront, where I've never been the hugest Scream fan either. Particularly where Scream kind of entered my life, I like that it sort of, like, injected a certain amount of, like, fun and energy into what at that time was a very languishing horror genre. But it also meant that Scream was the start of an entire decade of stuff aping Kevin Williamson's self-reflective, kind of self-aware meta commentary style as horror, as a teenage slasher, and that's what we got for the next 10 years. And I was never really kind of in love with that.
But, I mean, I think the thing that I vaguely remember, and I mean, I could be off because slasher movies have never really been my, like I like them, but they're not, like, my expertise. But I vaguely remember, like, in the time period that the first Scream came out, which, if I remember right, was probably like the late 90s, early 2000s.
Like 96.
Okay, so mid 90s. And I vaguely remember at that point, like, there was kind of like this resurgence, not that it ever went away fully, but there was kind of like this resurgence of slasher movies because we had there was the one with the hook. I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Yeah.
And then there was
all that stuff came afterwards.
Also, it all came afterwards. So yeah, so this kind of felt like, you know, it was the start of something that kicked off this, like, 10-year window of, like, slasher movies that didn't really take this route of the self-reflective, self-referential, but it did start something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the quick sort of history lesson is that we had, like, a little more than a decade of, like, solid wall-to-wall every week a new slasher movie is out in theaters throughout the 80s, whatnot. And it finally sort of, like, you know, you can't have a solid decade of anything without people getting tired of it. And so eventually the entire genre just kind of wore itself out. People stopped going to see Friday the 13th and Nightmare at Elm Street movies. And the whole kind of, like, horror genre just sort of, like, wound down and tried to figure out where their next kind of thing was coming from. And there didn't seem to be a really good solution through the beginning of the 90s, and horror just didn't have the popularity that it had in the previous decade. It just sort of, like, died down for a bit. And it wasn't until Scream happened in 96 that changed, and all of a sudden horror was big again. And that meant if you were doing horror, you were doing the Kevin Williamson version of horror. And there was a bunch of other stuff that we got in the meantime, but it didn't really substantially change until 2001, basically post 9/11, at which point horror sort of changed as a result of our, you know, our current environment, and started moving into a torture porn era because we were all of a sudden very concerned about the horrific things that people were doing to each other as human beings, as opposed to having fun with a goofy slasher, you know, in a mask running around stabbing teenagers. So that's just kind of like the sort of environment in which these films grew up. So Scream had a moment in 96 and the quick sequel right there afterwards. And then Scream 3 came out and people are like, yeah, okay, it feels like this has run its course. And then Scream 4 gets made quite a many number of years later and actually ends up being Wes Craven's final film. and is more or less like a Lego sequel at that point, trying to bring back Scream, and it's okay, it's fine. But then we have Scream 5, and this is the Radio Silence guys, the guys who did Ready or Not, basically taking over the Scream franchise, and it's sort of starting it, I want to say over, with new characters. It's like a specific storyline that's basically going on with the Melissa Barrera and Jenny Ortega characters as sisters who have basically inherited this horrible legacy due to the events in the first film. And Scream 6 is basically just a follow-up from there. This is like the same sort of storyline. 5 and 6 are intertwined movies. One is informed by the other, much more than any other of the previous films. But it's still following that kind of Scream format. So you have, like, it's essentially an American Giallo film is what it is. It's a mystery film baked in with a killer who's going to stab a bunch of people, and their identity will be revealed at the end as to why they were killing a whole bunch of people, and you'll be astonished as to who it is, and a lot of blood happens along the way. And the movies all reach varying levels of fun. Scream 6, I think, is the most fun this series has ever been, at least for me, including the first movie. I actually adored Scream 6. I thought it was so much fun.
I don't disagree. I certainly had a good time watching it. I don't know. To me, it was just like mediocre. To me, this isn't even like a horror movie. Like, there was very little in any of the scenes that were like horrific in any way. The most I ever kind of felt any sense of like dread or like fear of any point was the whole scene in the bodega, which I thought was like really, mm-hmm. really well done. But beyond that, it was kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, a Scream movie. It is what it is, I guess.
I think it's more suspense-driven, and I think it's really fun for that.
Yeah, it is.
It's also incredibly campy.
Yeah.
Like, the storylines play out like a soap opera. This is why I call it American Giallo, because this very much kind of fits what Giallo films are like. They all have, like, that level of campiness. They're all built around the mystery. They all have, like, the killer that's running around stabbing people. You know, it's Giallo is what it is. And it's a very fun version of it. And they managed to... What I really like about 5 and 6 is that they've managed to kind of incorporate not only what people want from a Scream movie, but have it be about something. Like, specifically this 6th movie, I'm just complaining about Knock at the Cabin. This movie gets into basically conspiracism as being the root of what's driving, like, all the violence that's going on in the film. And while it doesn't have a lot to say about that, it's at least touching on something and going, okay, here's like a real world thing that we can sort of like connect it to and talk about. And I think that's definitely a right direction to move with this film. And with this series, I'm enjoying what these guys are doing. I hope they do one more of these and then like move on to something else.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Do you think there's going to be another one? Because they've certainly left the door open for more.
Oh, it made a crap ton of money. So there's no way there's not going to be another one. We're going to get another Scream. There's no two ways about that. I think at this point I don't know if they said one way or not, if they're going to do part 7, but I think they would be silly to not at least do like a trilogy, and then if they decide they want to like move on, do other things, then that's fine. But you know, do the 3 films.
I would watch another one, no problem. I'm there for it. Okay, so yesterday I took myself and Dan to the movies in the middle of the morning. Did not realize I was in for a full day event because holy shit, John Wick Chapter 4. For a
3-hour movie.
John Wick Chapter 4 is legitimately 2 hours and like 47 minutes long. Like, what?
2 hours, 49 minutes.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
What is happening? I will say this. It does not feel 3 hours long.
Nope, it does not.
It does not. So basically, we pick up where movie 3 leaves off. John is still excommunicado. He is still trying to get revenge against the table. We have a bunch of new characters who are causing all sorts of havoc, and he is going to kill everybody to get revenge for his dog.
Basically,
let us not forget, this all started with them killing his fucking dog.
For a puppy.
And I love that there's a callback, like there are callbacks to the dog in every movie. Not necessarily that dog, but to dogs in general.
I think that's the secret of these films and why they're so successful and popular with people, for like even people who wouldn't go see this type of film.
The dog?
And it's because, not just the dog, but that the films at the core of them are very kind of pet-centric.
Yeah.
It's like the fact that the first movie is built around revenge for a dog, and then every movie after that has like love of animals at like the center of it. Even the one character in this movie, there's a pivotal arc surrounding this character that has entirely to do with nothing other than his dog.
Yeah.
And I think that is a secret sauce that gets a lot of people who do not give a shit about martial arts action movies to come in to see John Wick.
But holy shit, man. Like, I joked with Dan. Can you imagine you're like some stunt guy and you put on your credits, I was guy number 58 killed by John Wick. Because at some point, like, thug 58. Because at some point, you just lose count. There was a scene, I don't even know which one it was at this point, where I'm like, okay, let's count how many bullets are actually coming out of this gun. How long does it take him to reload? Legitimately, 7 bullets reload. Like, okay, so they're even like doing this. Somebody sat there, like when we choreographed the scene, we need to make sure that he reloads when he's out of bullets. Like, there is not endless bullets here. Like, just the attention to detail in these sequences, and the fact that they go on for as long as they do, and there are so many of them, and none of them are boring, is mind-numbing. Like, the level of sophistication of putting this movie together, never mind the fact that there is basically, like, 5 minutes of story, and then just, like, nonstop balls-to-the-wall action sequences. It's just, like, my mind is like...
So I rolled my eyes a little bit when I saw the runtime for this movie.
Oh, I rolled my eyes big time.
Yeah, because one of my biggest problems with the third movie was I enjoyed it, but it felt like it went on for like 20 minutes way too long. And by the time this last final action scene just won't end, as like, just conclude already. I'm over this movie now. I'm exhausted. It's time, and you're still going. It's time to end. It's like there reaches a point at which you just like you run out of energy for a film. And this movie is a good half hour longer than John Wick 3. And it's like there's no way they can keep it up. This is going to feel even more exhausting and worse. And somehow this movie manages to find that balancing act. And I think one of the ways they do it is they spread it so it's not all on Keanu. It's that there's a lot of other characters here. Anytime you start to get like a little weary of being with one character, you can switch over and see, oh, what's Donnie Yen doing right now?
Whose ass is he kicking?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like there's a lot of other little threads that it's able to pull to and like shoulder that weight. And I think it goes a very long way towards making this movie, I don't want to say endurable because that's a really horrible way of putting it, but making it so that a 3-hour movie does not feel like a 3-hour movie.
I agree.
At no point in this movie was I bored, save for maybe one action scene, which I felt like was... could have had like 10 fewer guys in it because it was just going on it was a little bit too long in the
scene. So which one was it? Was it the nightclub or was it the glass room thing in Tokyo?
It was the glass museum room thing in the Osaka hotel that I felt like just it a little bit too
long. I agree.
Could have cut that one down a bit. But other than that, I also can't get over just how freaking gorgeous this movie is.
Right?
Like, it's not just incredible next-level action that they're doing in these films, but they are absolutely strikingly gorgeous, neon-lit, beautiful. Literally every frame is a painting movie.
Yes.
They're so lush to look at. You know, it's like, I don't think there's anything that I particularly disliked about this. And honestly, if I'm going to rank them, this might actually be the best John Wick movie.
I agree 120%. And I'm with you. Like, what struck me was that final, like, showdown. Actually, it was the last scene, the very last shot after the duel. And they're standing, like, the sunset's coming up. And you're like, wow, that's so pretty. And I'm like, wait, but this entire movie has been like, wow, that's so pretty. It's so beautifully shot. For me, the moment that I went like, what is happening was that, like, how did they do that? That crane shot of that accident, it looked like a video game, kind of.
Oh, yeah.
And it just
goes. I call it the Hotline Miami scene.
Dude.
Where the whole thing is just like top down angle.
And it's like, I'm like, how many times did they shoot that? Because all the explosions go off at the right times. And I couldn't see any hidden cuts. I assume there might be one when they're going like maybe over like a wall.
Okay. If I was going to reverse engineer it, here's what I would do. I would, because it's obviously they got a camera in the ceiling that's pointing straight down on a rig that's moving around. If you map in the movement of that camera, which is the easiest way to do it, no one's actually controlling it. They've mapped it in and it's just running the thing. If you do that on a motion control rig, so it's running this perfect, the perfect camera move over this environment over and over, then you can comp in those individual elements. Very easy in the edit to get that timing exactly the way you want it.
It's still impressive.
So yeah. So and even though it looks like it's one unbroken shot, I almost guarantee you there's like 10 different shots in there.
I would buy it 100% because there is a lot going on and it goes on for like a good, I would say maybe four or 5 minutes. I want to see how they've made that. Like,
well, and what really sells that scene is that it's all with these shotguns that have explosive shells in them. So it's not just like he's shooting people with shotguns. It's like he's shooting people like, with fire and these burning bodies fall to the ground.
They're like, but they like legit like almost explode. They're like,
yeah. And it just looks so great.
It does. It looks amazing. This movie is so much fun. So, of course, I went looking. I'm like, okay, so the John Wick story is probably done. However,
yes,
we now have all of these new characters that we can play with. So there was...
I think the best way to put it is, like, the Keanu Reeves story is
done.
And that if they want to spin off this whole world building that they've done...
They will.
Into some other, like... you know, version of it, which starts to become unfortunate in the sense that you've titled the movie John Wick.
Yeah.
And then now you're going to have John Wick without John Wick.
Well, they could go, they could go the Fast and the Furious route and call it like John Wick something or other, or just leave the John Wick.
Then it was called Fast and Furious. That's the problem. Your branding is the dude's name. You're not going to do future stories.
But honestly, I would say that you could name it like whatever the order, and then subtitle it whatever. People will know because hey, at this point, the fans will know.
I believe at one point they were planning a spin-off TV series that was just going to be called The Continental.
Oh. That would be okay. I'd be okay with that.
But I don't know what the status of that thing is. I think it died on the vine.
I think this is like they've built a really cool universe. It's funny that it really feels like the first movie they made the movie thinking, okay, we're going to get one shot at this. Let's put it all on the table. Mm. And it's like, oh, let's make a sequel. Okay, let's grow this universe a little bit more. And now they're all like, clearly somebody has like created this entire back universe of the order, the table, the continental, like all of the hotel. I'm like, yeah, I'm here for all of it. Give me all of it.
Mm. Well, and it's wild because the first movie, it was made independently. Yep. Like, they made the film and, like, showed it to people and then sold it to Lionsgate. Yep. And that movie was made, they scraped together $20 million to make that movie. And this movie was had a budget of $100 million.
Listen.
So it's like, the John Wick series is a little bit of like a Cinderella success story. It's people betting on themselves
and winning big. I call this the magic of Keanu Reeves, which we should never underestimate. So, that is true. You know, I messaged Bill because Bill's like, not to burst your bubble, but John Wick is fucking amazing. I'm like, I'm going to go see it today. And I messaged him back. I'm like, Jesus, that thing was nuts. He's like, Donnie Yen is 60. I'm like, dude, Keanu Reeves is 58. Like, there are no young guys here. Like, these are all dudes that have been doing this for a long time. Like,
you know, between John Wick and The Matrix, is Keanu Reeves the greatest action hero of our time?
Hands down, I say yes. Keanu Reeves followed by Tom Cruise. That's where my money's at right now. Keanu Reeves because it's all like, I mean, they're both doing pretty crazy stunts in different ways. Mm-hmm. So I would say maybe they're in par, but yeah, hands down. They're both. Well, Donnie Yen is not out of the league here. I mean, the guy made
but he hasn't. Yeah, he hasn't done a lot of American
films. No, I mean, but the Yip Man thing, like those movies are stupid crazy. Like,
what one thing that kind of surprised me? Like, I've seen Donnie Yen in a lot of stuff. Iron Monkey is one of my favorite movies. I absolutely love that movie. But I think this might actually be the first English speaking movie I've seen him in, and I did not actually know his English was that good.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I don't think I've ever seen him in an English film either, or at least nowhere where he
speaks. I've only ever seen him speaking Cantonese.
Yeah, yeah. Go figure. I'm there for
it. But yeah, he's amazing in this
movie. He's so good.
As you would expect Donnie Yen to be, but like he, you know, it's not just that he shows up and he's an opposing force, but he is so charismatic and he owns every scene he's
in. Totally.
And even though he's like, basically, more or less, like, sent to kill John Wick. Every scene he's in, you almost want to see him win because you just love him so much.
You totally do. And you get the sense that, like, John, like, there's total respect there. And John is kind of like, if my life wasn't depending on this, you know, beyond this. And, I mean, in the end, that's exactly what happens, right? Like, they come together. But whatever. No spoilers. Not that you can possibly spoil this movie. It's just like.
Yeah, exactly.
Nonstop action.
Go and have fun.
Oh, man.
So but yeah, this is John Wick in its ultimate form.
Oh, it's the best. I loved it. Loved it. Okay, so now talk to me about We Have a Ghost, which I haven't seen.
Yeah, so this is a Netflix movie. It's from Christopher Landon, a guy who did Happy Death Day and Freaky, the one with the body switching horror with Vince Vaughn. This one is like just vaguely horror. This is the most family friendly version of horror that you're gonna find. It's very much a family movie, and it's basically Anthony Mackie and his family move into a new house, and their melancholy teenage son finds out that they have a ghost living in the house, played by David Harbour, who has the most fabulous comb over you've ever seen in your entire life and is wearing this bowling shirt. And by the rules of ghost logic, it seems to have, like, borrowed a lot of its metaphysics from the movie Ghost, about how ghosts operate in this world. He can't really, like, talk with anyone, and he has to, like, really kind of exert himself to kind of, like, try to impose any sort of, like, physical force on the world sort of thing. And immediately, just by virtue of, like, TikTok and YouTube, it blows up into this huge story, and you know, they become like a social media star. And what unravels is basically like trying to solve the mystery of like, who is this guy and how did he die and how do we like basically like allow him to find peace. And they go on this big kind of adventure as like the government gets involved and is, you know, trying to capture him for experimentation and whatnot, being chased by this scientist played by Tig Notaro. And it's just a really fun movie that manages to also be incredibly endearing and touching by the final scene of the movie, it actually had me in tears. It got to me. You know, it's, I love this movie. It was just an absolutely lovely movie. And if you're, like, at all wary about, like, you know, the idea of something being, like, too horror to enjoy, this is about the least horror type of film that you could do. It's like an Amblin movie.
Oh, I'm going to add this to the list. Maybe we'll watch this tonight because we're out of things to watch. We're not really, but we just need something new.
It is a nice, lovely time, and you'll leave the film with a huge smile on your face.
Oh, that's awesome. Sometimes you just need that. Let's talk about some TV, and why don't we begin with the show that has had everybody in a buzz for the last, I guess, couple of months, but The Last of Us. I mean, is there anything to say to, like, explain what this, do we need to even explain what this is?
I mean, I think I talked about it a few weeks ago while it was, like, still kind of, like, in flux.
Yeah.
I came in from it from the perspective of having incredibly intimate knowledge of the games, because having played through all the games several times, and so knowing the story really well, and it was really hard to kind of watch the show and be objective about it because I had so much familiarity with it already. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. It's a great adaptation of the game, especially the final few episodes. It adheres very closely to what's in the game. It's almost like one for one at that point. There's not a lot of deviation after a certain point. And I think because of my massive familiarity with the games, one of the things I enjoyed most about the series was those moments where they did deviate from it and go outside. Because in the game, you're trapped into, you play Joel, you're in Joel's perspective, Joel will talk to himself. It's all from that point of view. And then the show allows them to go outside that perspective to other people's perspectives and see stuff that you just don't see in the game. And it was that stuff in the show that I enjoyed the most because it's where I had no familiarity, you know, and was able to go off and enjoy something new. And then it felt like it was less, like, weighted down with baggage for me.
I really enjoyed the show. I like the emotional arc of the series. I like where things are going. I'm really curious to see how this whole thing with Joel now plays out, because he's essentially lied to Ellie after they've had this very open father-daughter type of relationship. And now all of a sudden, it wasn't even like father-daughter so much. It's almost like they're more like friends and comrades than... I don't know. I really like their dynamic. And now the fact that he has so blatantly lied to her, I'm curious to see where that goes. I really, really liked it. I don't really know what else to say about the show at this point. It's like everything has been said. It's been dissected to death. I don't really want to dissect it. I like the fact that it's a zombie show that is not so much about the zombies and more about the people. At this point, there's been so much zombie stuff, I'm kind of just done with it.
Oh, for sure. And, like, that was kind of the interesting thing to me about the show, is because when you play the game, the infected are a big part of it, and the roving gangs of raiders are a big part of it. And that's by virtue of you have this game that you have to have all these sequences of obstacles where, you know, you end up killing probably about 100 infected and 100, you know, raider dudes throughout the course of the gameplay. But of course, that's all just the player controlled gameplay part. There's no actual story really happening in that part. That's you having fun solving problems with obstacles in your path and getting in fights. And you don't need a lot of that when you're adapting it to do the show. And so a lot of that comes out. And when you remove a lot of that, you see how little the infected actually fit into that, because it's more about this is why the world is the way it is, more than this is a thing that we are having to deal with on a minute-to-minute basis in our lives.
Yeah.
And I think that definitely made it more interesting, because you're right. Last thing we need is another Walking Dead at this point.
Yeah. I actually think probably one of the... There were a lot of scenes that I really, really liked, particularly in the second half of the season. But I think my favorite might be that when Joel rescues Ellie from the hospital, where he basically like loses his shit and his mind just goes blank and he goes on essentially a killing spree, but you don't see any of it. I thought that was really well handled. And I like a lot of the decisions that they make for like advancing the story, where a lot of the stuff happens. A lot of times the scenes happen off screen and you maybe just like hear about them in passing, or you see them from a distance. I like that. And I think that's just like Craig Mazin as a storyteller, and that's how he tackles stories. And I do appreciate that quite a bit. I really did enjoy it. What I'm liking now that the series is done, there's been a little bit, I'm like a geek for making ofs, at least for some things. And there's been a lot of sort of like, this is how they made the show. And one of the things that I found most interesting was there, and I'll see if I can dig it up. I watched a YouTube video the other day about, which I didn't realize, they shot most of the series handheld. And so there's like this entire like mini documentary I'm making of about the cameras and why they decided to use the cameras that they used and the lighting of the series. And so then I went back and I rewatched like portions of episodes that they had like specifically mentioned. And I thought, wow, like it's amazing how much that adds to the overall feeling of the series. It's really, really good. I really enjoyed it. It's probably one of the best things I've seen. I mean, it's only like March, so, you know, there's lots of year left. But TV-wise, it's definitely one of the best things I've seen on TV this year so far.
I definitely won't spoil anything, but, you know, having played through part two several times, I know where the story is going, and all I can say is get ready to be kicked in the feels.
Okay, so this is a question for you, which didn't occur to me until now. But so does season one end at the end of game one?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, season one is the entirety of the first game. And so season two is ostensibly going to pick up years later.
Okay. Which is interesting. It's going to be interesting for, and now it makes sense because I did see some headlines about how they weren't going to recast Ellie. And I'm like, well, why are they going to recast her? But now it makes sense if it takes place years later, the thought that maybe they would recast her to somebody older.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember how many years passed between games as it is, but it feels like it's about 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
Ellie's like a little bit older. She's like full blown teenager by that point in the game. And honestly, I think they'll be able to do that just fine.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah,
I think Bella is playing probably like a little bit younger than she is in the show already, and so they can just age her up a little bit, and it'll be fine.
Yeah. So all to say, definitely worth a watch on, you know, whatever your streaming service of choice is that has HBO. Even if you're not a zombie fan, I would say this is definitely not specific to the zombie genre. There's a lot of human elements here that I think they really out-trump anything else, honestly.
And it was just really nice to see this get a good adaptation. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's a you see, most game adaptations, they all suck. Let's be real. They really do. And Last of Us was one that was not only, like, seemed ripe for a good cinematic adaptation, because so much of the game plays out in a very cinematic way, but it's a story that I really liked, and I wanted to see it done well, and I felt like it could be done well. And so it's very gratifying to actually see it be successful and do well and be embraced by people too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by not just by people who played the game, but by people who have never touched it and had no idea what they were in store for.
For sure. I wanted to mention this, and I thought about maybe leaving this until the season is over, but I think it's worth mentioning even though they're mid-season, and that's Star Trek Picard. And I'll preface by saying the first two seasons of the show feel nothing like season three. Like, I'm like, season one is its own entity. There have been three seasons, right? Oh, shit.
I think so.
Season one is definitely the most memorable. Like, season two just kind of came and went and some stuff happened, but I couldn't tell you what happened. But season one had, like, it introduced, you know, it reintroduces Picard, brings in a whole bunch of new characters, new actors, and then they no, they kill some, they like move away from others, and then you're like, well, what the hell is, where are they going? So season three is its own, like, at this point, they've jumped forward, I don't even know how many years, I think. It's inconsequential. But basically, you end up with Picard and Riker in some, like, adventure in outer space. They end up with Seven of Nine, who's now just known as Seven. And all, slowly, so they have this season-long story arc that is only, like, vaguely related to anything else that's come in the series up until now. It basically, it's a standalone season. It really is. But they're slowly bringing back all of the TNG characters. So we are now at a full cycle where we're, I think, six episodes in, and everybody that was of any importance in Next Generation is now part of the story. And it's not the Borg. So go figure. Like, I'm still trying to figure out exactly what's happening. But dude, I have to say, I'm so thoroughly enjoying this. It's so much fun to see, like, these actors and these characters that you've known for so many years, and you've seen a bunch of movies. Most of them have not been great, but, you know, a few are worth watching. But it's kind of just fun to see them all come back together. And the way that they've, clearly the writers on the series are fans, and the way that they've, like, worked the character interactions, and even the way the characters are written back into the story. Thumbs up from me, like, all in. I am so excited to see where the rest of this goes, and I'm really sad that this is it. But I'm also kind of like, this is a nice sort of like closing bracket to Next Generation. And I will say, the only thing this series is now missing, and this has nothing to do with Next Generation, but then I think we can get away with it since we have Seven. We need Janeway to make an appearance, and other than just name. Like, they keep, oh, Janeway. Where the fuck is she? Can you just, like, bring her back? Because I'm all here for it. But all that to say, Picard is awesome. Awesome. And you don't need, okay, and you don't need to watch season one and two. Like, they're whatever. You don't need them.
I have not watched any of them.
So good. Of the new reboots, I have mixed feelings about the new reboots. I think Discovery started off well. It has not continued well. New World is probably the best of the bunch. And this one, I think, has, you know, its ups and downs. Season two, clearly a miss for me, but season one and now season three are thumbs up. Let's talk a little bit about a show I had not even heard of, Liaison. Mm-hmm. What is this?
Before I completely sold you.
Oh, you told me who was in it, and I was like, sold! Where do I watch this?
Yep. So, Liaison is a new series on Apple Plus, which is a espionage dramatic thriller starring Vincent Cassel and Eva Green.
What?
Which, if you want a sexy cast, you can't really do much better.
No.
Than that. Like, have you ever wanted to see a show where Eva Green is pulling taser leads out of Vincent Cassel's back?
Really?
Yeah. I'm
so in.
I know. This show's, I don't know if fun's the right word. I'm enjoying the show a lot. I'm really digging it. And it's basically, it's a lot less Jason Bourne and more like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Mm. In that sense, it's more like kind of Le Carre in that sense, but maybe more of like a more kind of like, I want to say dumbed down Le Carre. It's the best way to put it. Basically, Vincent Cassel is essentially like a mercenary at this point who has worked for various governments, but he's essentially been tasked with chasing down and stopping this terrorist organization, and this brings him into collision with Eva Green, who is essentially working for a division of British Homeland Security cyber ops, essentially. I'm not sure what the actual department is, but basically dealing with any sort of, like, you know, cyber attacks that might be threatening London. And they start to get attacked in a big way, like, you know, shutting down bridges and stuff like that, and their infrastructure being shut off by hackers. And so she's embroiled in that. And because they're sort of, like, separately involved in the same sort of kind of incident involving these terrorists, it brings them together. And they at one time had a torrid romantic relationship that they have both parted from unamicably many years ago. And so she's not really happy to see him again, even though she holds a part of him very dearly in her heart and always will. And he still very much is holding a candle for her and, you know, would love nothing to get back with her, but is not going to completely disrupt and uproot her life to do so. And it is dealing with all the espionage that enters their lives that forces them to sort of get back together in a on-again, off-again sort of steamy way. It is directed by, I want to say, Stephen Hopkins directs, like, a bulk of the episodes. And it's a, I don't know, I'm really enjoying the show. It's smart, but not too smart. It's fun and lively and move forward, but it's not really an action show. At best, you'll have, like, a foot chase here and there. And it's mostly just about these characters trying to find political and underground avenues to basically solve this crisis. Like, there's a large kind of plot point that deals with Eva Green having to deal with the rest of the European Union that harbors a lot of ill will towards Britain at this point because of the whole Brexit thing. It's like, oh, you need our help now. Well, you know, and she has to, like, walk through that sort of red tape to get political help for an ongoing active threat to the country. So it's, you know, there's a lot of really interesting stuff here, and I'm really enjoying it. It's about midway through the season, so I'm not sure where it's going yet and whether or not it's going to pay off in any sort of, like, successfully cathartic way. But at the same time, I'm watching Eva Green and Vincent Cassell do it the whole time, so I don't care.
Sometimes that's all it takes.
Yep.
Sometimes that's all you need. It really is. I'm certainly curious to watch it. I'm adding it to my watch list. So we're burning now that I have a little extra time.
I think you'll dig it.
Oh, I probably will. Come on, those two together. Hello, chemistry. And I haven't even seen it yet. But we're blowing through TV like there's no tomorrow. So I'm always looking for new stuff. I want to mention mostly just in closing because I feel like I've had a relationship with this show, which is funny because it's a show about relationships. But I came to Sex Life season one very late after all the drama and hubbub with Sex Life. And I really, really enjoyed it. I thought the show was really doing some really interesting things. And it was, yeah, it was a little bit sexy, but it was like nothing like, you know, I don't know. People made it sound like it was freaking porn. Honestly, I thought there was more sex in season one of Bridgerton than there was in Sex Life. But whatever. Besides the point.
Were people getting all puritanical about the show?
And that's the thing, because I watched it like after it had already dropped, it'd been on Netflix already for a while, and I think it wasn't even in the top 10 anymore. So the conversation had kind of moved on. So I was looking at it from reverse, because I just watched it, so it was all fresh, and I was reading all the drama that had happened when people watched it when it first dropped. But yeah, I think that there was maybe a little bit of oversensitivity about how much sex there is in it, which honestly, there really is not that much. There are some scenes that are, maybe it's thematically was the problem, because it's essentially the story of this woman who is happily married, clearly not fully happily married because, you know, she is having issues with her husband, and then her ex that she loved at one point is now back in her life, and maybe she's having a relationship with him. And so season one had some really interesting explorations about relationships and sex and love and how all those things are interconnected. And I thought that showrunner Jamie Denning was doing a really interesting job of exploring avenues of female sexuality that aren't always explored, especially when you're talking about married women. And I thought that that was interesting. And I'm like, okay, well, where are we going to go with season two? And season two feels almost, I think it was impossible that the show was ever going to keep up that level of like drama, just because of everything that happened in season one. Season two feels a little more, I don't want to say deflated, but it definitely does not have the same energy that season one did. And this series is much, it still deals with some really fascinating concepts about individuality and, you know, being your own woman and what exactly does that mean. And probably one of the most interesting parts of the show is her best friend's sort of trajectory, because when you pick up in season two, she's released this best-selling book and she is like building like a social media presence as this independent woman. And then she has to grapple with what exactly does that mean, because her publisher is like, well, you can't have a boyfriend because then you're no longer an independent woman. And then she's like, well, but if it's my choice, is that not me, you know, exercising my right as a woman, as an independent woman? So there's some really interesting minutiae there. I still really enjoyed it. It's not as sexy as season one. So guys, you know, don't, you know, kill anybody, but it's basically Bridgerton season two. Like, there's very little in the way of sex. There is some, but not a lot. But it still deals with some really interesting themes of relationships and sexuality. So, hey, if that's what you're there for, you will not be disappointed. And then it just kind of ends. I don't know.
Personally, I think that's a good thing. I think it's been overblown a bit online, because every once in a while someone will come out with, like, some statement where they say, I don't think there should be sex scenes in movies or TV shows ever, and they always get dunked on, and you see it a million times, and it feels like these people are way more omnipresent than they really are. At least that's my take on it. At the same time, I think so much of our media is so incredibly puritanical. I mean, we talked about that one article talking about superhero movies, how everyone is sexy and no one's having sex.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it feels like our popular culture is at, for the most part, where we're very concerned that everything be sexy, but that no one is getting it on. And I think we need more getting it on in our media.
Fully agree. 110%. 110%.
Yeah. More sex. That's what we want. That's, if nothing else, that's what our podcast stands for.
Now, listen, the title of this week's podcast is More Sex. Happening.
There you go.
All that to say, it ends, season two is basically the end of the show. I don't think we're going to see any more sex life, but, okay. Somebody was mentioning to me that, Sarah Shani was on, The L Word, and I've now heard it from like five different people. They're like, dude, you got to watch The L Word. She was so hot in that show. I'm like, okay, sure. So apparently I need to watch
The L Word. I'm not sure that, God, I have no idea. I'm just going off the top of my head here. Because I watched L Word a long, long, long time ago. Because it's like, what, 2000?
Easy.
It's like 20 years old. I'm not sure the L Word has aged particularly well.
This is my thought. Like, there's a lot of those, not those shows, like, but there are a lot of shows from that period that I'm like, I don't think I want to go there. It doesn't look like it's aged particularly well.
Yeah, I'd be curious to find out how well that show holds up, but that would be my intuitive guess, is that if you watch that show now, you go, oh, that's kind of crazy.
I may have to see where it's streaming, and if it's somewhere accessible, I might have to watch an episode or two just for the hell of it. And to close, I wanted to mention, because I only know about this show because you have brought it up to my attention. I saw a post the other day that The Blacklist has now celebrated episode 200.
Oh, wow.
What? I thought of you. I saw the archive. I'm like, wait, this is Ashley's show.
They're in their final season. I don't know. I'm in the middle of season four right now. I'm slowly making my way through it. Because I mentioned this before, like, when I was originally watching it, I watched, like, 1.5 seasons, and then I fell off. And when I saw the show was still going, I decided to go back and take a look. I was like, this is really enjoyable. Why did I stop watching? So I'm doing, like, a full 10-season watch of the show. Like, season 10 will probably end before I even get there. But I'm going to watch the entirety of the show all the way through. And we'll see how it goes. Right now, I'm still enjoying it.
Anything else before we call it a show?
No, I think that's it for now. I think that's a lot.
That was a lot of material to cover. Lots of TV and movies.
A lot of great stuff in theater.
There has been a really, like, last year was still, maybe you can still blame kind of COVID for last year. But I mean, I know a lot of people went back to the movies last year. And I think in total, I went to the movies like six times. And I watched the same movie twice. So this was
No, we had Scream a few weeks ago. Went and saw John Wick like on Thursday. I have not gotten out to Shazam yet, but I do want to see it. And then we got Dungeons and Dragons out in a week, which looks like it's fantastic.
I'm so excited for that show.
There's so much stuff in theaters right now. It's great.
All this to say that this is probably the most exciting I've been, excited I've been for movies in a while. And I've already been out to the movies more this year than almost all of last year combined. And it's only March. And
and it's like this until the end of summer. There's like something like every 2 weeks that you want to
see. Yeah, exactly. And those are all stuff that I would venture out to see theatrically for sure. So I'm going to try to make the time for Shazam next week. Definitely going to try to make the time. Like, Dungeons and Dragons is happening. Like, it was happening like 3 weeks ago, but there was that new trailer in front of John Wick. And I was like, okay, this trailer is taking this shit out of itself, and I love it. I love the movie for it. Love it. Cannot wait. So that's definitely upcoming. Until then, where can folks find you?
People can unfortunately find me back on Twitter at Ashley Lynch.
And you can find me on Letterboxd. It's pretty much, Instagram and Letterboxd. That's pretty much where you can find me at this point. The Marina one on both. We'll link to that in the show notes as well. We'll also link to all of the
stuff. I know I've said this before, but only if we could only get more interaction on Letterboxd, it would be
amazing. Oh, it totally would. Mind you, I say that, and I literally, the only app I've opened in 3 weeks is basically Instagram. I'm still on that boat. But we'll link to all of this along with show notes and timestamps in the show notes, so that if there's something that you don't want to get spoiled for, you can follow the timestamps and skip through the show to what you want to listen to. And in the meantime, we'll be back in a couple of weeks with more. So until next time.
Insert catchphrase here.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.